Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Chris Champagne about his new book, Secret Louisiana. And we'll hear the second part of my interview with Kalamu Yassalam, whose new book, his first published novel, is Walkin' Blues, a meditation and speculation on the life and legend of Robert Johnson. Chris Champagne is a writer, a performer, a comedian, a poet, an all-around great New Orleans character. He's the author of The Roach Opera, that New Orleans classic The Yat Dictionary, The Most Interesting League in the World, How the NFL Explains America. And he can also be a wonderfully funny and idiosyncratic tour guide, as he was in his charming little book, Secret New Orleans. And now he's back with Secret Louisiana, an unusual guide. Chris Champagne, welcome back.
Thank you, Susan. Nice to see you.
So you've given away state secrets in this book now.
Well, actually, I can't divulge any secrets.
All right.
Yeah, yes, I am.
Shortest interview on record.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Trying to save you some time.
So how did you choose these entries?
Well, I researched in books and online and different things, and I've stopped at a lot of tourist places, that they have, and that the state has, and asked people for things. And unfortunately, a lot of things that I was looking for, they weren't there anymore, which is interesting, I think, in a sad kind of way. And a couple of things I just kind of fell into. Mm-hmm. I took a wrong turn in Baton Rouge, and then there was this house adorned with all this metallic artwork, and there was these two guys working on it. So I stopped. I said, let me take a picture of this. And they asked me what I was doing. And it turned out it was a gentleman's house, and he brought me in and showed me all around. And you can't really go in the house because it's a private residence, but the outside is adorned with, it was like a work of therapy, he said. it's interesting. It's in a very swanky neighborhood around LSU. Then another time I was in Shreveport, and I was stopped at a red light downtown Shreveport near the river in the kind of the tourist area where the casino is, and there's a few museums and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I looked to my left, and there was a sign, and they have these signs all over that area, like the government complex this way, City Hall this way, whatever. And I looked at it, and it said at the bottom, it said Zombie Hall of Fame this way.
I could resist that.
So I went immediately to find out about that, and there was no Zombie Hall of Fame, or never was, but somebody just made a sign that looked just like the official sign and put it up there. And then when they found it, then they left it there.
That's a kindred spirit of yours, I think.
Yeah.
Now, there are a lot of really interesting small museums in this book.
Yes.
Like the American Museum of Fencing.
Yes, that's an interesting one for sure. That's another one. I saw that, and I went online to see if I could find anything about it, and I really couldn't find anything about it, so I thought maybe it was closed. So when I was in Shreveport, I called the number, and a guy answered. And he said, oh, yeah, we're here. You come over anytime you want. And he teaches fencing.
Wow.
And he's a very interesting guy. He's from New, he was born in New York City. He grew up next to a gold medal fencer. And so he took up fencing as an eight-year-old. And he was an All-American fencer at Temple. Then he moved to L.A., where he taught movie stars how to fence. So I asked him, how did he get to Shreveport? And he said, well, he says, my girlfriend's from Shreveport, and she was nice enough to move to Los Angeles. So when she said she wanted to move back to Shreveport, I figured I needed to be nice enough to move back to Shreveport.
All right.
And he has all the stuff. He has all the trophies and memorabilia from American fencing. So he's a big deal in American fencing. And his name is Andy Shaw. He's a really very nice guy. He spent a lot of time with me.
It sounded great. And then there's, I love taxidermy. It's a weird thing, but I do. And there's the Touchstone Wildlife and Art Museum.
Well, that's one of the more interesting stories for me in the book, because it was a great place. I went back three times because my publisher kept asking me for different photos. So I had to go to some of these places. I traveled over 14,000 miles in my car.
Wow.
So anyway, I went back to this place. I'd been there 10 days before, but he didn't like my photos. So I went, and the place was closed. And it had a sign, and it intimated that they may never open again. So I took a piece of paper, and I wrote a note on it, told him about me. And I folded it up, and I put it in between the cracks of the doorway. So I figured I'd never hear anything again. And 10 days later, I get a call. And they said that they had an underwriter locally who was going to help them continue, and that they would have called me sooner, but it rained, and my note got wet. So that was kind of a really serendipitous thing that I thought that all that happened, because I really loved that place. Uh-huh. It's really an old-time roadside attraction.
Yeah, you can tell.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I think it's worth a trip.
Yes, it is. It's not too far from Shreveport.
And then, of course, the Louisiana Political Museum and Hall of Fame in Winfield.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Kind of out of the way in the middle of the state. But it's interesting. I mean, the signs especially, they have signs all over the place. So, you know, if people, when they ran, you know, like Dr. Mignard's, the coroner's sign when he's in a white suit on a horn and things like that, and bumper stickers. And it's the hometown of Huey and Earl. So they have they have mannequins of them pose. And you could actually listen to Earl Long's voice and press some buttons and listen to him on the stump.
Wow. Now, it was interesting to me how many of these places you found were attached to the military in some way.
Yes. Well, you know, a lot of people might not remember, they had these things called the Louisiana Maneuvers that were right before World War II, and they trained like about 500,000, you know, soldiers in Louisiana before World War II. So there's that famous scene in Patton in the beginning when he talks about, I'm not going to quote it, but it's about Louisiana, and it's because that's where a great number of the troops were trained in Louisiana, because the America wasn't ready for the war militarily. And there's a beautiful old hotel in the middle of Alexandria called the Bentley.
Oh, I love that place so
much. Yeah, and if you don't know about it, if you're taking a road trip, you should just take a look at it. And that was the headquarters where Patton and Eisenhower and all those guys, you know, the big wigs, would stay during the maneuvers. There's an interesting story about Patton, about the maneuvers, about that nearby. There's a small town. I can't remember the name of it right now, but they had the war games, that were depicted in the Dirty Dozen, actually. And they had a red team and a blue team. And when one of the blue team or the red team showed up on the banks of the bayou there, there was a general store, and they had some kids there, and they had a cannon that they had gotten for Christmas, and they shot the cannon at the forces, and the forces thought that they were being attacked by the other team, and then they had firecrackers, and it was Patton's army, so basically they ran Patton's army off with firecrackers.
Oh my gosh. Of course you have some stuff for dog lovers in this thing too.
Yes, yes. There's the grave at Homer's house.
Of the married dogs.
Of the married dogs.
The adorable married dogs.
Yes, yes. And I'm glad I got that one in there. And there's an unfortunate story of Admiral Byrd's dog.
Unalaska?
Unalaska, yeah. Admiral Byrd was having a national tour, and they took the dog for a walk, because his lead sled dog from his expedition to the South Pole, I think it was. Anyway, well, the dog got loose, and he got hit by a car, and he was unfortunately killed. And the children of Monroe put their pennies and nickels in to bury him again, because the first time he was buried, there was a huge monument that they had put into a World War I cemetery. The next day, after the cemetery, somebody stole this huge monument and threw it in the river.
Ah.
And they never did find out who it was. So the children of Monroe actually put their nickels and pennies in together to have a grave for the dog. And he was buried on an elementary school, which is now a retirement home. But the grave is still there in the middle of Monroe.
Far away from home.
Yes,
and
yes.
And all his adventures.
Yes, very far away, yeah.
Now, of course, you have to have a cemetery. And then Talbert Pearson Cemetery in Vernon Parish.
Yeah, that was
different.
It's a kind of a Southern tradition that's been lost, I think, that they would build enclosures around their family's tombs and with roofs and everything. It was interesting. I mean, I thought I would never, that place is so out there in the wilderness, I thought I would never find it. And I passed it up about four times before I finally found it, because they have a church, and the church isn't the same name as the cemetery. And I almost missed it, but I'm glad that I didn't, because it's really nice. That's a beautiful photo. It's a nice photo.
It really
of that
is.
In the air. And then there's the Frenier Cemetery in Laplace, which isn't very far away. And the story behind that is that there was a lady who lived there. It's a small town right outside of Laplace. She was like a traiteur or maybe a voodoo practitioner or whatever, and healer. And she would sit on her porch, the story goes, and sing songs. And one of the songs that she sang is, "One of these days I will be gone, and I'm going to take the whole town with me."
Yeah.
The day that she died, there was a Category 4 hurricane, and it wiped the city out, the little town out. And
whoa.
But the cemetery is still there. But you have to take a swamp tour to see the cemetery, because it's out in the swamp.
You got to take a boat to get.
Got to take a boat to get to the cemetery. Yeah, it's a very nice little tour, though.
And then in New Roads, you found a drive-through funeral home.
Yes, in fact, you know, I went to visit Ronnie Virgis when he moved to New Roads.
Yeah.
And we went to have lunch. He said, "Let me show you something." So he brought me over there and showed me that. I was up there with a friend of mine who's not from the United States. She's from Europe. And I told her, I'm going to show you something. I'm not going to tell you what it is. So I drove up to it, and I said, she said, "What is it?" And I said, "It's a drive-through funeral home." No, get me away from here. But Ronnie's the one that turned me on to that one. So
now I knew about the frog murals in Rain, were really pretty, of course. But I did not know about the Hickory Railroad in Jackson.
Yeah, that's
kind of charming.
Yeah, it is. That one's kind of like tucked away as well. You go through Jackson, and it's right off the road. I think it's Highway 10, and it's every Saturday, I think it is. or maybe it's just every Saturday, once every month. I can't remember. It's been so long since I started this book, but I've been there a couple of times. And if you're a model railroad buff, you can go there and you can talk, you know, shop with these guys. They can help you fix your trains. And
I love that.
And they have a setup for every scale. So it's pretty extensive.
So what's your favorite of all the places in this book? Can you pick one?
Well, let's see. One of my favorite places is the Tree of Souls. And it's right off of Interstate on Scott. It's about two miles one way and 2 miles the other. And it's out like in the middle of nowhere, some farmland. And it was a lady that had a special needs child, and she wanted to do something for him. And she had a sign put there to unburden yourself. It's a religious sign, but it's mm-hmm. to unburden yourself of your woes or whatever, whatever's bothering you. And the idea is to throw your shoes onto the tree or to nail your shoes to the tree. Now there are three trees that are now designated that way. There's hundreds of shoes on them. And it's a tree of souls, but it's not S-O-U-L-S, it's S-O-L-E-S. My favorite thing is kind of a selfish thing, I think. And I kind of just found this by luck as well. A friend of mine got a job working at a master carpenter at LSU. There's a maintenance barn. It's like right near the LSU stadium, by Tiger Stadium, across the street from where that airplane is, that fighter plane. So nobody really sees this. So there's this board in there. It's a purple and gold board with a chalkboard on each side. It was for the 1946 Vanderbilt LSU football game. And there's a chalkboard next to it, and it has space for all of the people who were in the starting lineup of the LSU team that day. And Y.E. Tittle is chalked in as the quarterback, who's a very one of the most famous players of all time. But two above him is the right tackle of the starting lineup of LSU that day. That was my dad, Ed Champagne. So that was kind of cool to find that one.
Oh, Chris, that's really great.
It was, yeah. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we haven't talked about that I think that's pretty interesting. And Chimp Haven's pretty interesting.
Chimp Haven is.
It's the biggest place in the world where they have retired chimps. Mm-hmm. And you can only go there a certain amount of the time, only certain days, I should say, a year, a few days. But you can contact them and get the information. And Audubon Day is an interesting one as well. They have the Audubon Folio at LSU. And one day a year, you can make a reservation. You can go up and they'll show you all of the whole folio. That's kind of an interesting one. That was fun to do that.
But you know what's interesting about this book? Wonderful photographs. It's wonderfully organized. It's just, it would be a great project for a family to take this book and start visiting all these places
it would be,
together.
Yes.
But the last two words in this book are climate change.
I did notice that I mentioned it quite a bit, I think, depending on where I was, you know, but especially down in Chauvin around there, you know, Cocody, places
stuff.
Like that.
Yeah. We got to see these things while they're still here.
Yeah, that's true. But it's also the same with the things that I tried to find that weren't there anymore. So the Touchstone Museum, for example, I mean, the gentleman, he started it like 50 years ago. And of course, he's gone now. And his family carried it on. But it's a tough road to carry something on like that. So some of these things just aren't going to be there for a variety of reasons.
Well, thanks for celebrating them, because this book is pure pleasure. You just enjoy everything. These great stories, great pictures.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Makes you want to saddle up.
I appreciate it very much.
We've been talking with Chris Champagne about his charming new book, Secret Louisiana, An Unusual Guide, perfect for planning your next road trip around the state. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much.
Two of my interview with Kalamu Yassalam, whose new book, his first published novel, is Walkin' Blues, a meditation and speculation on the life and legend of Robert Johnson. The other thing this book is a lot of love stories.
Well,
a lot of really great love stories.
I don't know. Oh, it's thank
they
you.
They don't always end happily.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that it's love stories, because I really believe that I learned life and that life for Black people, because we didn't have much else. We couldn't be major politicians. We had to love each other. Literally, there was nothing else you could hold on to that was meaningful. And this was the period right before, during, and after the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it. I mean, I really, in some cases, experienced it. I was telling Eric Waters, who's a good friend of mine, we were school buddies together in high school, 61, I believe it was. But anyway, I was telling Eric when we were coming out here to UNO, I said, you know, we were traveling, riding around and trying to find a place. say, you know, we used to do this and we used to do that here and so forth and so on. And the love stories was, when I said we, it is no secret. This is no secret in Robert Johnson's life,
mm-hmm.
that who we became as human beings, our manhood was involved with women. Mm-hmm. And the women were often the major movers in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Starting with the mothers.
Starting not only with, yes, you're right, starting with the mothers, but also, again, very briefly, I was part of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. and the women were the stalwarts of the movement.
Yeah.
Although you can't tell it from looking at a lot of the publications and movies, the movement would not have worked without the women. And those relationships were central to the development of the movement.
Well, I want to ask you to read from the beginning of the book so people will get a sense of what okay. the book feels yeah. like when you read it. And it is Robert Johnson on the road with a friend.
He had his shoes in the croaker sack and his guitar. Three jars of preserves, one jar of figs, the other two was watermelon rinds, plus two huge biscuits, larger than his fist, wrapped in the edges of her apron, which Sweetwater had torn without hesitation and lovingly sacrificed as an offering she hoped would also be an enticement for Robert to return to her after he found whatever it was he was looking for in Louisiana. Whatever it was that could not be found here in the warmth of a Mississippi woman's kitchen, the resting place and wrestling place of a Mississippi woman's bed. She had not been able to resist caressing his chest after she set the bundled biscuits on the table next to the mug of steaming coffee. Sweetwater had not cared that all the fine food she had fed Robert would cost her 2 weeks' worth of work. His company had been worth much more than 12 or so dollars, especially that morning she awoke, looking at his naked back as he sat on the edge of their bed. Really, it was her bed that she wished would be their bed. His guitar in his lap, softly singing a blues that did not sound at all blue, but rather tender and gay, although she knew neither of those words through her own experience. So little in her life had exhibited either character, yet here was this slender man, an angel singing the devil's music, perched not even an arm's length away. And she had reached out to press a palm to his spine, tracing straight down to just above the cleavage of his butt, which is what all she was remembering when she had placed that offering before him. She had cooked cornbread on the stove in a black skillet for a few minutes before. But this was her first oven-baked delight, lovingly given to a man, especially on the day when he was saying goodbye. Well, at least it had been a wonderful 8-day week.
8-day a week. This is very tender writing, Kalamu.
Oh, I don't know about that.
It's I think so.
you say it's tender because most writing that we read has been written by men who were talking about the world, but not about their real feelings about women.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kalamu Yassalam, whose new book, his first novel, is Walkin' Blues, a meditation and speculation on the life and legend of Robert Johnson. The other thing about this book that I admired so much is that it's a parable or a portrait of the creative life. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk at one point about two of his mentors who were so important to him were Charlie Patton and Son House.
Son House, yeah.
And how he always put himself in a position where he could learn something from people. That was his attitude going through life. And at the same time, you show him playing by himself and working things out as he plays. And then you show the mastery he had over crowds and how to bend them to his will and the magic of his music. And that's an unusual combination of things that an artist needs to have, right?
I grew up with a lot of those people, and coming from the Lower Ninth Ward, New Orleans, we had Boogie Bill and a bunch of other people. But these were people I knew.
Yep.
I didn't look at them the way we might look at a performer today and say, oh, that's so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And they did not have all of the quote-unquote accoutrements of fame and fortune. These were just
people you knew.
People I knew. And so that's what, and I imagine that's what Robert Johnson was like. In fact, he died before the Lomaxes, younger Lomax, wanted to present him at Carnegie Hall.
Right. And went looking for him.
And went looking for him, but he'd already died by that time.
I know, that's the heartbreaking thing I've ever heard. So what made you think it was time to get back to this book?
To get back to this book?
You've done a lot of work on Tom Dent's papers and writings.
Well, you know, you do what you can
you
when you can.
You do what comes up, I know.
And you do it whenever you can, you do it. And this book is one of many books that have... many books. It's part of the body of writing that I have. And it's sort of like a well or a feeding trough. You dip your cup in it and you get a drink and then you move on and do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't think about it that much. People who have wells or feeding troughs for them, they don't think about that yeah. much. You know, that's just part of how you survive, so you do it.
Yeah, but at some point you had to sit down and say, I'm going to finish this now.
Well, it's funny you say that because it's not finished.
I know. Now I know that.
It's not finished. I mean, even in the book, it stops after his adventures with Zuli, which you talk about. You know, if you read the book, you know. But he wakes up one morning and doesn't recognize where he is, and then he realized this was Zuli's place. It used to be, but this is just a shack. Now ain't nothing. And, well, I grab my hat and make my getaway, and he starts walking on the road again. And that's the way life is.
Whistling.
Yeah. You just walk
on. It's the perfect ending, too, for this book. Perfect.
Again, thank you for saying it. You could say it. I mean, I was just writing.
Well, I'm glad there's going to be more. I want you to fall in love with novels now and keep at it.
Well, it's a lot of work.
And yeah, I know.
A lot of stuff I want, quote unquote, I think about doing. And we'll see what happens, what comes up.
We've been talking with Kalamu Yassalam about a wonderful new book, Walkin' Blues, about Robert Johnson. And Kalamu, I loved it so much. Thank you so much for this beautiful work.
Well, thank you very much.
If you care to look back at part one, you can find it on our website at wwno.org. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jeanette Weiland signs her new children's book, Alligator Stew, Saturday, December 7th from 10:30 to 12:30 at Octavia Books. R.F. Kuang discusses and signs Babel, Yellowface, and the Poppy Boar. Saturday, December 7th from 4 to 6 at Baldwin & Company. Jan Rischer discusses in Sign's Question of the Day, encouraging conversation and connection. Sunday, December 8th at 11 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop. John G. Anderson and Anthony Thaxton sign The Bicycle Logs of Walter Anderson. Wednesday, December 11th from 6 to 7:30 at Octavia Books. Blue Cypress Books presents the Willow School Creative Writing Showcase. Wednesday, December 11th at 6, when students from the Willow School Certificate of Artistry Creative Writing Program present their work. Chris Champagne signs Secret Louisiana Thursday, December 12th from 6 to 7:30 at Octavia Books. Gypsy Rose Blanchard will be at the Garden District Bookshop Friday, December 13th for an author meet and greet for her memoir, My Time to Stand. The evening will begin at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Michelle Dumont, author of a new children's book titled Phoebe Cakes the Bulldog, a Mardi Gras tale, will be the featured speaker at the annual Jefferson Parish Children's Book Festival at 9:30 a.m., Saturday, December 14th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This event is free of charge and open to the public. Other children's authors on hand include Gary Olipio, Karen Connorth, Louis Duet, Laura Roach Dragon, M.H. Herlong, Leah Eskin, Rachel Marsh, Laura Michaud, Gideon Hodge, and others. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.